These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled European History and European Lives, 1715 to 1914, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Jonathan Steinberg. Professor Steinberg is the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of Modern European History and Chair of the Department of History at the University of Pennsylvania. He completed his undergraduate work at Harvard University, after which he served 2 years in the U.S. Army Medical Corps. He received his Ph.D. from Cambridge, where he was University Lecturer in European History, Fellow of Trinity Hall, Cambridge, and Vice Master. Professor Steinberg served as an expert witness in the Commonwealth of Australia war crimes prosecution and was also appointed to the Historical Commission of the Deutsche Bank AG Frankfurt am Main to look into bank activity under the Nazis. Professor Steinberg is the author of Yesterday's Deterrent, Tirpitz and the Birth of the German Battle Fleet, Why Switzerland, and All or Nothing, The Axis and the Holocaust. Professor Steinberg has written numerous radio and TV documentaries, including the BBC Radio 4's Salute to the U.S. Constitution, Secure in Their Persons. He is a member of the Board of Trustees of Franklin College in Lugano, Switzerland, and the Presidential Advisory Commission on Holocaust Assets. Professor Steinberg prepared the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a glossary, a timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. History as a Soft Science.
Welcome to this new course of lectures, European History and European Lives. The course begins in September 1715 with the death of Louis XIV, and it ends on August 3, 1914, when, as Sir Edward Grey said, the lights went out all over Europe and the great guns begin to destroy human lives in a mass industrial slaughter never seen before. Now, in this lecture, what I want to do is provide a kind of roadmap for the course. The basic idea of the course is to tell the history of Europe from the aristocratic early 18th century to the outbreak of the First World War through the lives of colorful personalities who traversed its landscape. Each life, in a highly distinctive way, helped shape the 18th century and what I think of as the long 19th century, the period from the French Revolution to the outbreak of the First World War. And this course looks at 35 such individuals. Though it's biographical in scope, the object and aim of the course is to explain how each of these lives embodied a critical, specific stage in European development or represented new and powerful ideas that propelled the continent toward modernity. And these two centuries are absolutely crucial in European development. They begin with a world of privilege, poverty, disease, and inequality, the so-called old regime, whose way of life and standard of living were not much different from that of the Romans or the Chinese Empire. And it ends with cities, technology, a new kind of state, and mass modern society. At the end of this period in 1914, Europe is like our own world, and a new human self set in a new social reality has become the dominant actor. And the lives we study affect and create this process. Some are monarchs, some are politicians, some affect the economy, some have to do with gender relations, some have to do with industry, banking, or science. There are philosophers, writers, and artists. In one lecture, we shall look at the disaster of a whole people, the Irish famine. And they're the actors. That generation is the biography, the collective biography for that lecture. Now, this course is frankly an experiment. I have never done it before, and I have never seen anybody crazy enough to try it either. This is simply something that nobody's done before. And the basic question is, can you do it? Can lives embody the great forces and factors that historians often describe as impersonal? Is biography a way to see the whole story through the optic of an individual? That's the challenge for lecturer and student alike. Now, what is this great transformation of Europe about? The transformation from the old regime to mass society. The term itself, old regime, is a historic artifact. It was invented after the French Revolution to describe what went before. It describes a lost world of privilege, aristocracy, serfdom, and poverty. Now, how does it become the modern world of cities, technology, mass movements, and equality? And the main features of the transformation I'd like now just to outline very briefly. There's a sudden explosion of power, European power, in the period that we're looking at. Between 1715 to 1914, Europe becomes supreme in the world, and it becomes obvious. By 1914, Europe, together with the English-speaking former colonies, the United States and Japan, enjoyed a near monopoly on high technology. And you can think of it, a symbol of it, in something like the gunboat, gunboat diplomacy. A small European state like Belgium could send a gunboat up the Congo and subdue great empires and tribes. A second change, which we take for granted now but is fundamental, is the rise of the secular state. In Europe, for the first time in human history, a state founded on reason and natural law grows up. It ends the divine right of kings and the whole traditional way of seeing kingship and rule. And in this, there is a kind of social contract, a great revolutionary experiment. The state is the creation of the people, as the Constitution of the United States says. The people contract, so to speak, to construct their new authority. And this new state expresses the people's will. It can be conceived as a reformer. It can provide welfare. It can provide education. It can provide public health, clean water, whatever the citizens want it to do. Now, with that change, the belief in the yoke of sin, the conviction that mankind is born in sin, gives way in those two centuries that we shall be studying to the idea that human nature is fundamentally good and that it can be shaped by our own efforts and indeed by the activity of the state. The great Enlightenment project begins between 1715 and the 1760s, and its idea was to use human tools to perfect human nature. And this Enlightenment project continues really, I suppose, until the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the end of communism. For all the modern isms, fascism, communism, liberalism, nationalism, believed they knew how to make us happy and virtuous by human devices. A third feature of this great transformation, again we sort of take for granted but need to think about, is the exploitation of science and technology. There's an agricultural revolution which brings new crops and new rotations, and for the first time in human history, famine disappears, and it happens in our period after 1848. There's new technology. The steam engine multiplies the capacity of labor by multiples measured in horsepower, and by the 1830s produces a transportation revolution in the railroad, and the telegraph, invented in 1833, offers instant communication. And there is, and this is much less noticed, a new technology of measurement. There's a development in statistics. Data filing, the card file, is invented in 1774. Surveying of roads. And all these kinds of techniques give the political authorities new sources of power. The state knows about its citizens in a way which it has never been possible before. And this process, of course, continues in our own lives. It's now possible with smart cards to have everything about us available to the state, from our blood group to our income tax category. Industrialization is another phenomenal and important change which takes place in the two centuries that we shall be studying. The new technology and the new science and the new machinery are applied to human work. And the factory embodies the multiplication of human power by assembly lines. and mechanized, simplified production systems. You get new products and new markets, and the traditional old-fashioned market gives way to the shop. England becomes a nation of shopkeepers, in Adam Smith's famous phrase. And when you think about it, a shop represents specialization of trade, specialization of distribution, you need wholesalers, you need a whole system, whereas the traditional market is just a place where people bring their wares. The consumer is born in our period. Now, why England was the first to industrialize is a really complicated problem. Historians don't agree, and we don't have to solve the problem. But what we'll look at in Lecture 3, when we look at Sir Robert Walpole and the first bubble economy of the modern period, great crash of the South Sea bubble in 1720, that trade produced a huge amount of capital accumulation in Great Britain, no doubt the slave trade an important element in that. And new financial institutions, banks, stock exchange, began to grow up, which allowed for the investment to move around and for speculation to occur. People began to collect where employment grew up, in the so-called factory towns. And with them, you get new kinds of problems, new kinds of slums that had also never been seen before. And although people forget it, economics itself, the idea that there is a thing called the economy, which can be studied by theory, is a product of this era. And we shall look in Lecture 13 at the greatest economic textbook ever written, Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, which is one of the three revolutionary events of 1776. And it could be argued that Adam Smith's textbook is at least as important as the American Declaration of Independence. Then there's demographic change. About 1700, for reasons which are still not entirely clear, there's a sudden growth in European population. Epidemics decline, medicine and health improve, nutrition and diet also improve. And here, too, demographers are not certain how or why it happened. But there are consequences. For the first time in our period, humanity faces the problem of overpopulation, but not, in fact, the starvation which is expected. As we shall see, the general view was that this population could not be fed. Malthus published his great book in our period in 1798, and we shall talk about that later. There's a fantastic change in the nature of war in society. In the 18th century, war was a military chess game. Professional soldiers used fixed maneuvers and stylized tactics. Armies enjoyed long winter pauses, and most of the ordinary people were not involved. In fact, Frederick the Great used to say that when he went to war, he wanted his citizens not even to know that it was happening. The French Revolution, which ushers in the modern world, transforms war because it transformed the whole of society. And when we look in Lecture 16 at what Robespierre and the French revolutionaries actually did, they introduced the War of the Peoples. Because they created citizens, they transformed the whole nature of war. The people were drafted. Everybody was drafted in the French Revolutionary War, including animals and old people. They all had jobs to do in the people's war against the enemies of the people. And that, too, was something absolutely new, which had never been seen before. It wasn't true in the Roman Empire. It wasn't true in the Chinese Empire. This vast mass of people fighting against its enemies. And it turned out, and is still the case, the democratic war is much more destructive than the old professional elite war. The old war of the elites responded very much to the needs of other elites. You didn't destroy your enemy. But when democracy was unleashed, there was no limit to war. And we end our lectures on the eve of the great destruction of the peoples in the trenches in the First World War, the beginning of the tragedies of the 20th century of industrialized mass killing, which of course ends in the Holocaust. And then there's another change in our period, which is very remarkable, and so far as I know, again, has no real parallel. And that's the transformation of art and the public sphere. Before 1715, the arts represented the crown or the altar. The arts served a patron who had a political or religious power or a political or religious message to send. I mean, take the case of Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel. He's a great artist. He's already international reputation. But his patrons are people who have political or other needs. He's painting the Sistine Chapel for Pope Sixtus. It's part of the Pope's glorification. After about 1750, something really odd happens. And this is, I think, new. Art becomes a commodity for sale to the public. And the public is a new phenomenon in the whole of human history. It's again something we take for granted. An anonymous public, armed with its pocketbooks, can go out and buy art. And there are all sorts of consequences of this transformation with which we are, of course, still living. The new artist was no longer a servant, was no longer somebody who wore livery like Haydn did in his entire political career. He was just a servant of Prince Esterhazy. The new artist is a genius. The new artist is selling the products of his or her soul to the public. And the artist is sometimes critic, but you also need critics to tell the public what to buy. And sometimes the artists sell their own things, and sometimes other people sell them. And in Lecture 9, we'll look at the music of Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, the son of the great father, who actually was one of the first people to sell music. His father, perhaps the greatest musician of all time, never sold a piece of music. It wasn't part of Johann Sebastian Bach's world. He worked for either a prince, or he worked most of his life for the church. It wasn't part of his art to be sold. So we have a whole series of enormous changes, and I would argue that the sum of these changes make Europe itself exceptional in the history of the world and create the modern world in which we now live. Now I want to pause for a minute and think with you about the advantages and limits of biography as a way to understand these changes. Now, how is this course actually going to work? I hope what will happen is that you will see in each life a principle or a set of practices or some long-term trend which is embodied. So, for example, let's take the two enlightened despots of the 18th century whom we shall be looking at, Frederick the Great and Joseph II. They were more or less contemporary, and both were imbued with an idea that you could make the state more efficient, more productive, more useful in war by applying the laws of reason. So that's why we speak of them as enlightened, because they read the philosophers, they read the new theoreticians about how society should be organized, and they thought, right, we can apply this and make our societies much more productive. So what we see then is the king as a state builder. Because after all, the state itself is a creation of the period we're looking at. There wasn't a state before. When Louis XIV was asked, what is the state? He said, l'état, c'est moi. It's me. What is this state? Frederick the Great said, I am the first servant of the state. That is, out there, there is some entity, some structure, which is not the king's personal property. So we see the king as state builder and reformer from above. And although both kings were absolute despots, they ran into the limits of their projects. As we shall see, Frederick the Great was caught in a dilemma which he could not solve. There is no way that an absolute despot can actually run an absolute state rationally, because he's absolute and everybody's scared of him. So they all lied to him. And Frederick was caught in the coils of his own absolutism. Joseph, who was even more extreme, ran up against limits which have to do, I think, with human nature. People could not be made better by reformers from above. Another way in which biography should help us to see the modern self emerge. When we look at the lives of somebody like Hume, the philosopher and skeptic in Lecture 8, or Rousseau, the first person to confess his true inner life, including his sexual life, I think in the whole of human history, or Mary Wollstonecraft in Lecture 17, the founder of feminism, who takes enlightened principles and applies them to women for the first time, or George Eliot, who not only makes women the heroine often of her books, and we should look at Middlemarch, which I think is her greatest novel, but is herself a new woman. Or Goethe, the artistic genius who converts himself into a work of art. We watch something mysterious but recognizable, that is, the birth of a new subjectivity, the new human self, the kind of people that you and I actually are. Then, if we look at three different figures, Robert Walpole, Adam Smith, or Nathan Meyer Rothschild, we see the emergence of capitalism and the first stages of globalization and the emerging capitalist society. Walpole is the first person in a modern society to experience, although the Dutch sometimes claim this, the first bubble economy and how it's solved. Adam Smith wrote the textbook for modern capitalism. Adam Smith could not be refuted and never has been refuted, although what his message is, as I shall suggest, is not what most people today think it is. The Adam Smith society doesn't read the master carefully enough. And when we come to Nathan Meyer Rothschild, we come to an absolutely amazing phenomenon. Here is a a Jew from the ghetto born in the 1770s, who in 25 years is the richest man in the world. And as we shall see, Rothschild's fortune relative to his age was much greater than Bill Gates is to ours. Rothschild was so unbelievably rich because he had invented the new capital, international capital market. Then we look at the Krupp family in Lecture 32, who represent a new kind of industry, the great iron, coal, and steel industry, the world of the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers and the American robber barons, who become the representatives of the new industrial, military-industrial complex in Germany in the 19th century. When we look at the new public sphere and the sale of artworks and the mass marketing of culture, we also notice something very remarkable. And that is, it produces a new sort of religion of art. And we're going to follow this in two stages. In Lecture 6, we're going to look at the life of Dr. Samuel Johnson, the first English literary figure to live without a patron, and C.P. Bach, I've already mentioned. And these two represent the 18th century stage of our great change. The painter Goya marks the transition from court painter to popular painter. Wagner in Lecture 27 and Tolstoy in Lecture 34 represent the cult of art in an industrialized society. Then we're going to look at several kinds of revolutionaries and their opponents. Robespierre, the great French revolutionary, the head of the Committee of Public Safety, who genuinely believed it was possible by introducing a new political structure to make human beings virtuous, and where they, when they were not virtuous, it was not because the people were not good, but because spies and evil people were suborning them, and he began the first modern mass execution and invented modern terrorism, in the sense that the Great Terror is the political model from which all subsequent terrorists come. Mazzini, the enlightened nationalist, who believed that nationality would make people free. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, who believed that the abolition of private property would make people free and virtuous, represent three new types of revolutionaries not seen before in human history. Then we'll look at various types of conservatives. Prince Metternich represents the old-fashioned conservative, who sees things from the top. Edmund Burke invented modern conservatism of a traditional kind. It's history, not ideas, that really matter. No human ideas will ever be able to solve our problems. We'll look at Pius IX, the greatest pope of the 19th century, and perhaps the greatest pope of modern times, who condemned absolutely everything to do with liberal society. And we shall try to understand the logic which made Pope Pius IX believe that everything that liberalism represented was an error, as he described it in the Syllabus of Errors. And then in a kind of odd way, in Lecture 27, we're going to look at Wagner, who is a pivotal figure, starts as a revolutionary, fights in 1848 on the barricades, ends as a reactionary, and creates at the same time the greatest cult of an artist and an art form in modern times, the Wagnerian cult, which we shall look at its temple of the arts in Bayreuth. Now, scientists and reformers come next. Pasteur and Charles Darwin embody the new prestige of science. Along with Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, The Origins of Species is certainly one of the most important books ever written. And we look at both Pasteur and Darwin in the relationship between science and society. And then we look at David Lloyd George, who represents the modern politician, the new demagogue in the name of social reform. I want also to look at the Jewish problem in modern history? Because after all, European history, I suppose, in some sense, comes to its end in the smoking ruins of Berlin in 1945 and the piles of corpses lying inside and outside the great concentration camps. Nathan Meyer Rothschild and Alfred Dreyfus, lectures 20 and 35, represent two lives on the stage of Jewish emancipation on the road to modernity. And as we shall see, both in different ways embody certain profound kinds of anti-Semitism in the modern world. Then we shall look at the way certain old elites deal with the old world. In the lecture on Otto von Bismarck, one of my favorite characters, the German statesman who unified Germany, and Queen Victoria, who allowed the democratization of English politics, permits us to see two different strategies for dealing with the emergence of mass society. Bismarck, a kind of reactionary revolutionary, played the democratic card to get round all his opponents, but for reactionary ends, to make sure that the power of the King of Prussia stayed intact. And Victoria, in a very mysterious way, allowed her monarchical powers to erode slowly and gently over 60 years. Now, all of these lectures will try to set the individual into a social context of his or her life and to achieve this kind of unity. So the lives should be a way to understand the changes of the period. For me, this preparing these lectures has been a voyage of discovery. I have learned an amazing amount that I did not know. Goya, for example, was new to me in all sorts of ways. But much more important, I learned to see connections which I didn't know exist. Now, let me just say a quick word or two about the limits of biography. There are, I think, roughly speaking, two ways of thinking about the past. What I think of as hard history and soft history, my private terms for distinguishing two domains of historical evidence. Hard history covers demography, quantitative history, economic history, all those things that you can count. Since people are both subjects and objects, as objects they can be counted, as consumers their aggregate behavior is measurable, statistics and computerized research provide something close to what you might call objective knowledge about the past. Soft history deals with biography, politics, and society, where the evidence can't be measured, and where, in a sense, the evidence talks back. All our actors will speak to us in their own words during this course of lectures, and that's the most important single thing I will be bringing you, the fact that you will hear them speaking in their own voices. Now, as a consequence, certain problems are not easily understood through a single life, which is why Lecture 24 offers the biography of a large mass of people, that generation of Irish who suffered the potato blight of the 1840s. And the long-run elements, and what did Keynes say, in the long run we are all dead, are not likely to be well covered by biography. No one life, even Queen Victoria's, is long enough as a span to cover all the great phenomena like population growth, nutrition change, and industrialization. I shall try to point these trends out as we go on, but I'd like you to keep them in mind also. Another thing which is worth noticing is that biography has returned as a method of study and of selling books. In the 50s and in the 60s, when I began my career, serious historians did not do biography, and they would never remotely have conceived of doing a course like this. A proper historian did forces and factors, all those model-building exercises which seemed to be so much more scientific, and biography was left to amateurs, most of whom were women. But biography is back. Biography as a technique has become very popular and has produced some of the best-selling books of our time. Just think of them, the Ben Franklin by Edmund Morgan, or the John Adams by David McCulloch, a whopping bestseller, Robert Caro's Big Study of Lyndon Johnson, Theodore Rex by Edmund Morris, Winston Churchill by Roy Jenkins, the two-volume history of Hitler by Ian Kershaw, Mussolini by Richard Bosworth. Now, there are all sorts of reasons for the return of biography, and it's not clear why these things happened. It's quite a recent phenomenon. One, I suppose, is the declining prestige of the social scientific models. The fall of communism dragged the social scientific approach down with it. The explosion of religious fundamentalism across the world was unexpected and not predicted by social scientists either, who thought the world was becoming more secular. So biography comes back, and it has certain advantages. It tells a story. A life is inevitably lived on a timeline, and hence the historian must use the narrative techniques to describe it. Teacher and student have to be aware of these real constraints and the real choices open to them. Thus we begin a process of reconstruction of what it might look like from the actor's position. The human dimensions of the problem come near when life is seen as emblematic. The forces and factors combine in a human life. Now a final quick word on the objects of the course. Are there lessons of history? Well, not exactly. The problems of history are mostly too complicated to be packaged in little lessons, although politicians and people in the public do ask us often for it. For example, Vietnam in 1968 was the same as resisting Nazism in Europe in 1938. It wasn't, and the comparison led to all kinds of catastrophic decisions. But the comparative approach, which I'm going to develop in these lectures, is a useful alternative to the laboratory of historical science, which doesn't exist. We cannot rerun the past with the variables altered. But what we can do is compare tightly marked comparisons and see how the different sorts of phenomena operate. We can draw certain modest lessons by comparing the phenomena. But I hope that the most important thing about this course is that it will actually be fun. These lives are really interesting. Theodor Fontane, my favorite German novelist, and the best novelist, I think, of the 19th century, wrote, "When Bismarck sneezes or makes a toast, I find it more interesting than the wise speeches of six members of parliament." Now, these are great lives. These are lives of fascinating people. These are lives which I think show us the greatest example of what it is like to be human. And looking at these lives and understanding them is deeply pleasurable. To listen to their voices is, I think, the greatest single joy of this course. And I hope very much that European history and European lives will ultimately be, more than anything else, a tremendous amount of fun. Thank you.